Please turn in your Bibles to the book of Micah, Micah chapter 4, Micah chapter 4. We're picking up where we left off last week in Micah chapter 4, verse 5. We're going to be picking up at 4, verse 6, and reading through the end of chapter 5. And we're going pretty briskly through the book of Micah, and I think that's a good thing. We're going to do it in about 5 sermons. And the book of Micah, as I noted a few weeks back when we started, is divided roughly into 3 chunks. In each chunk has a woe section, which means bad news, and a comfort section, or a good news section. We're in the longest of the 3 good news sections. We started in last week with chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. We're continuing with the second half of chapter 4 and the rest of, and all of chapter 5. And what I'm hoping that we'll see in this passage, and I'm going to be breaking it up as I read it. I won't read the whole passage at first. But what I'm hoping that we'll see in this passage as a whole is that Micah teaches us that, first of all, that even in exile, God will rescue and bless his church. Even in exile, God will rescue and bless his church. And second, Micah will teach us how we should prepare ourselves for that salvation and blessing. How we should prepare ourselves. So let me start out chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. Just read 2 verses. In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and those who have been driven away and those whom I have afflicted, and the lame will make the remnant, and the lame I will make the remnant, and those who were cast off a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from this time forth and forevermore. So basically, the Lord is saying through Micah 2 simple things. He will gather up the lame and the scattered, and that he, the Lord, I am, will reign over them. And he says about gathering them together, the lame and the scattered, 2 things. First of all, he says that they will become a remnant, and second, they will become a strong nation. And I have to tell you that when I read that, I feel like that's a contradiction, right? Because very often when we talk about remnants, we're talking about the last, you know, the last dribble at the bottom of the cup, the dregs from the wine glass, the chopped down tree stump that's just sort of sitting there and it's dismal. And a lot of times Christians can take on what we might call a remnant mentality, where they view themselves as the last faithful remnant, the last few. It used to be great. Everything's going downhill. The Lord has brought judgment on us. We're the remnant. We're the last few. I guess we should just sit here and try to preserve our holiness and, maybe someday things will get better, but who knows? I actually don't think that's the way that the Bible looks at a remnant. A remnant is not only the thing that's left when disaster has come, or when exile has happened, or when the tree gets chopped down. It's not just the stump. It's the stump and then whatever grows out of the stump. So you could think about a really old tree, maybe not a nice one that's cared for in a park somewhere, but you could think about if you've ever been out in really old forest where you find these remains of trees that are just enormous trees that have fallen down. And what you often find is that not only was there this old, old tree that's fallen down, but a new tree has grown out of it. And sometimes it's a huge new tree that's grown out of it. Biblically, that huge new tree is the remnant. It's not just what remains of the old dead tree. It's the thing that's grown out of it. It's what God has taken and grown out of the remainder of what was there. They will become a remnant. God will make them a living thing that grows out of the remains of the past. And they will become a strong nation. And the Lord will reign over them forever. And what a glimpse of the kingdom that Jesus preached, isn't it? Jesus comes and preaches a kingdom. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are all the losers, basically, in Jesus' preaching. What is Micah preaching here? But that God will make a kingdom out of the lame and the scattered. These are not the winners among sheep. I've lived on a sheep farm. Even the winners among sheep aren't very impressive. But these are not the winners of the sheep. These are the lame sheep that are easily picked off by the predators. These are the scattered sheep that wander off and die by themselves. The Lord will take people like that and make them into a great kingdom. The remnant, again, is not the stump. It's the stump and whatever grows from it. And it could be, and in God's providence, it is a mightier kingdom than what preceded it. This is a beautiful thing. We do not always have to think about the past as like the good old days, and we know that that'll never happen again. The remnant is something that can be greater than what came before it. All right, next section is just a little one verse. Chapter 4, verse 8. And you, O tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you shall it come. The former dominion shall come, kingship for the daughter of Jerusalem. This is cool. This is one of the first. This is the first of three places in our passage today where Micah will address the daughter of Zion. Now that's a way of speaking to Jerusalem using a title for Jerusalem. It shows up a number of places in the Bible. But it's a very special title for Jerusalem, as we'll see in a minute. The kingdom will return, it says, first of all, to the tower of the flock. And again, that means Jerusalem as well. Now, what does that mean? What's the tower of the flock? It's not a tower made out of sheep, right? Although that would be fun. It's a tower that was intended. This is actually another shepherding term. They're all over the Bible, of course. But a tower of the flock is basically a little watchtower that would be built so that shepherds could look a long way and keep an eye on the sheep. Okay? Now, if a great city like Jerusalem, and in Micah's day, Jerusalem had become a great and very powerful city. It was a city that was very difficult to besiege. The Assyrians, actually, in their own records, have a terrible time finding water anywhere near Jerusalem. Because Hezekiah, in his wisdom, had actually built out this tunnel that tapped into the pool of Siloam, and he kept all the water supply inside Jerusalem in times of siege. If this great city becomes just a watchtower for sheep, on one level, that's a disaster. That's not what you want, right? You don't want New York City to be reduced to a fire tower, right? That's a come down. On the other hand, it's also a glimpse of hope. Because it's not just a ruin, as we looked at last week in an earlier passage in chapter 3. It's not just a ruin. It's not just a forest. It's not just tumble-down rocks and some wild animals and some trees growing out of it. It's a structure. It's God beginning a new thing. It's a place where, if the shepherds are faithful, they can call the people back together. And so Jerusalem being the tower of the flock is not such a bad thing after all. Then he calls Jerusalem the daughter of Zion. And again, this is referring to the city, but there's an accent here. It's referring to the Jerusalem being a place of beauty and stability and fruitfulness. We can think about Psalm 144, where it says, "May our sons in their youth be like plants fully grown, and our daughters like corner pillars cut for the structure of a palace." That there, and we can think about other psalms. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine, right? These are pictures. This is viewing Jerusalem not just as a place, and not even just as a people, but as something beautiful, fruitful, stable. These are beautiful portrayals of Jerusalem, the tower of the flock, and the daughter of Zion. But they're also great pictures of the church, aren't they? Think about that. Think about the church as the tower of the flock. Think about it, the church as a watchtower from which we look at the world and we see that God has sheep all over the place and they need to be cared for and they need to be gathered together to a place of safety. That is amazing to me. Think about the church as the daughter of Zion. Think about the church as beautiful in God's eyes. We'll talk about that a little bit more later on. God is saying to us, and God is saying to ancient Israel, you are wandering and divided, aimless and lawless, and you're vulnerable, but that will not last. I will bring you back together. I will make you beautiful again. I will care for you. And kingship will return to you. It is gone, but it is coming back. Now we get to the next couple of verses. Not all the sections will be this short, but these are. Verses 9 and 10. Now why do you cry aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished, that pain seized you like a woman in labor? Writhe and groan, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in labor, for now you shall go out from the city and dwell in the open country. You shall go to Babylon. There you shall be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. Whew, this is a loaded, loaded passage. The picture here is that the daughter of Zion is crying out in pain, that she's in distress, as if she's in labor for a child. And Micah says, don't give yourself over to that. You are not forgotten. Do not, in your pain, forget that you have a king and a counselor. And what a good word for us, that no matter what our situation, no matter how difficult it is, we have a king and a counselor. We are not forgotten. We are not neglected. We are not without guidance. Now, he goes on to say, daughter of Zion, you're not going to avoid exile. You will be brought out from the city and dwell in the open country. You shall go to Babylon. You're going to leave Jerusalem. You're not going to like that. You're going to be going through the wilderness for some time. You're not going to like that either. And now you're really not going to like where you wind up, which is Babylon. You will go into Babylon. But then, he says, there you shall be rescued. Another translation might say, there you shall be delivered. And there's a sense of being delivered from your child, of a child. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. Exile will actually become a blessing to you in a way that you can't anticipate. It will become a place of relief and a place of fruitfulness. So I thought immediately of Jeremiah chapter 29, the famous passage where God has Jeremiah write a letter to the exiles in Babylon. And he says, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Big key there, God did this. It wasn't just an accident of history. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. In the days before its exile, Jerusalem is groaning, is in trouble. There's oppression going on. There's tumult. There's fear about the future. But God is saying through Micah, oh, you're going into exile. But don't be afraid of that, because it will become a place where you bear children. It will become a place where you have peace and the Lord rescues you from the hand of your enemies. I also thought of Revelation chapter 12, and bear with me because Revelation's always a wild ride. But some of the same images are in this passage, where God writes of the church being this woman who is groaning with labor, and that the dragon, the enemy, Satan, wishes to devour. But then God takes the church and her child into a place of safety in the wilderness. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Exile need not be disaster. Let's get this straight. Exile is inherently disaster. But in God's kindness, it doesn't have to be. Now, what does that look like for us? Now, just in our individual lives, exile can look like a lot of things. Exile can be when we are not where we want to be, place-wise. I wish I lived, fill in the blank, but I'm stuck here in Rhode Island. I wish I lived in that city, but I'm stuck in this city. I wish my kids could go to that school, but I've got to do this instead. Exile could be I'm stuck indoors for a long period of time when I'd really rather be out and about. It could be very trivial or it could be very big. Exile could be when our plans and our hopes are not working out. Really good ones are not working out. Exile, perhaps, is above all when we are not with the Lord in heaven. Paul speaks of it this way. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. Paul's a soldier. Paul's a soldier, and he understands he doesn't go where he wants to go. He goes where the Lord sends him. And sometimes the Lord sends him into exile. So what might God be saying by keeping you in exile? And I think if any of us are really serious, we might look at our lives and see something where we say, this is not where I want to be. I want to be somewhere else. Maybe he's saying, I am teaching you patience. I am teaching you who is in charge. You are not ready for the thing that you want so much. There are more important things that you need to be doing right now. I am teaching you to trust me. I am teaching you to love me more than you love my gifts. Chapter 4, verses 11 through 13. Now many nations are assembled against you, saying, let her be defiled, and let her eyes gaze upon Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his plan, that he has gathered them as sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make your horn iron, and I will make your hoofs bronze. You shall beat in pieces many peoples, and shall devote their gain to the Lord, their wealth to the Lord of the whole earth. The picture is really vivid. It's more vivid than the translation will allow. The nations are gathered around knocked down daughter of Zion, ready to assault her and gloat over her. But they do not understand the plan of the Lord who gave Zion over to such trouble. And they don't understand that God has gathered them together in order to thresh them like wheat. They think they're gathered together in strength. They're gathered together so that they can be processed for grain, for flour. The daughter of Zion will arise and will make them an offering to the Lord. There are places I've been reading in my own devotions. I've been reading the book of Joshua, and there are lots of things in Joshua that make me uncomfortable. Lots of places where the people of this city or that city are to be completely destroyed and killed as an offering to the Lord. Now, it doesn't mean that in a very literal way, but it's saying, God is saying, this is what is going to please me. You're going to wipe them all out, and I'm going to take their place and give it to you. The daughter of Zion, in the same way, is going to arise from her place of shame and make these nations that have gathered around her an offering to the Lord. Now, it really is true that the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And it is in the nature of rebellious human beings to build bigger and bigger towers, to use all the Lego blocks in one thing, to expand their empires, to forge one ring to rule them all in the fires of Mount Doom. We always want to build a bigger thing, and the bigger the thing is that we build, the stronger we feel we are. And we begin to decide that right and wrong, justice and humility, peace and contentment, truth and reality are all things of the past. They are categories that if we're clever enough and strong enough, we can redefine and forget about. We start to tell ourselves, and every age does this, we start to tell ourselves that this time it will be different. We've figured out all the bugs. We will make it last. We will build something so big it cannot fail, and we will become gods. But the gospel of Jesus Christ always gets in the way of that pride and that hubris. Because at a very basic level, at the most fundamental level, the cross of Jesus holds up a mirror in front of human greatness and shows us that human greatness, human might, human cleverness is flawed at best and a hideous, murderous lie at worst. And furthermore, the resurrection of Jesus shows us that human greatness, human power, does not have the last word. The race is not to the swift. The battle is not to the strong. The gospel will triumph. The daughter of Zion will arise and thresh her enemies. David will defeat every Goliath, even if we don't see how. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. But you, are you listening? But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be the ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. When the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our palaces, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. They shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and treads within our border. In all of those 6 verses, there is only one command given to the hearer, and it comes right at the beginning. In our translation here, it says, "Now muster your troops," that it literally says, "Gather yourselves together," or "pull yourselves together." And it's addressed to the daughter of troops. 3 times God has called Jerusalem daughter of Zion. Now he calls her daughter of troops. And this is because this is a picture not of the church in its humility, not in the church even in its beauty and its praise before the Lord. It's a picture of what we call the church militant, the church on the march, the church going out and conquering the world in the name of the Lord. And it should remind us of Song of Songs, chapter 6, verse 10, that famous passage. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? In chapter 4, it was daughter of Zion. Now it is daughter of troops. The church is not only blessed, stable, beautiful, and fruitful, she is also dangerous to the world. And the world at a fundamental gut level knows it. Not by setting out to be intimidating, not by taking up arms, but by allowing Christ to act through us, we become dangerous to the world around us. And this is a paradox in the Old Testament, but not a paradox in the New Testament. When we know of the death and resurrection of Jesus, we see now that even though it may make no sense, God acts through the faithful obedience and sacrifice of his people, even when they seem to fail. And then how is it that that can happen? Well, the answer comes in chapter 2. A ruler is coming from Bethlehem. A ruler is coming from Bethlehem. Well, is it David? David came from Bethlehem. His father, Jesse, is described as an Ephrathite. Say that 3 times fast. Someone from Ephrathah. Is this David? Well, kind of, yes. It's another king who is to be born in Bethlehem. It's another king who would come, as Matthew, the gospel writer, says, in fulfillment of this very prophecy. Another king born in Bethlehem some 700 years later. And we see how the shepherd will act. He will bring his servants into the picture. It says seven shepherds and eight princes of men. But he will do this in his own time and in his own way. He's not waiting for us to win the battle. He will arise and he will do these things. And all of this passage focuses not on what we are to do in order to rescue ourselves, but on what he will do to rescue us. Exile will continue until the time for birth. Then exiles will return to Israel. Then the ruler will shepherd in two ways. He will be a shepherd like David was, only more than David was. He will shepherd them in two ways. First, he will care for his people, it says, in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. He will be our good shepherd. That's what the one born in Bethlehem came to do, to be a good shepherd to his people, to lead them, to protect them, to feed them, to water them, to heal those who are sick, to bind up those who are injured, to seek after those who are strayed, and to judge between the sheep and judge the fat and the strong, as Ezekiel speaks of in Ezekiel 34. But second, he will defend his people from invaders. He will both defend them and go after those invaders. So we read that he will raise up shepherds and princes in order to defend his people within the land, but then he will push back and attack Assyria and Babylon. It speaks here of the land of Nimrod. That means Babylon. And Babylon and Assyria very close to each other, and they were sort of pushed back against each other for control of what's now Iraq and the surrounding world. This shepherd will not just defend his people, he will go into the land of the enemies and shepherd them with the sword. Shepherding with the sword, that doesn't sound like nice shepherding to me. It sounds like somebody's going to die. And that's precisely what is intended here. So what are we to do? What are we to do as we await for this prince and king and good shepherd to act? Pull yourselves together. Pull yourselves together. I thought about this and I thought, how would a militia, you know, we live in New England, right? Very proud of colonial militias that all got their flintlock rifles and mustard and whatever kind of weird uniforms they were able to put together and then marched, maybe with the Continental Army, maybe after it, or maybe just shooting at redcoats any chance they got. How does the militia prepare for battle? I would say four things. First, assemble. This is the most straightforward translation of this, most straightforward application of this. Pull yourselves together. Muster your troops. You get together. We worship together. We're assembling before the Lord and putting ourselves at his disposal. So we assemble in worship. We assemble also by seeking unity with other Christians. And as important, as helpful as denominations can be, at the end of the day, unity starts locally with relationships with other believers that we know here, where we live, and relationships with other churches. And thirdly, we would stop dividing over party politics. I am at and past the stage where I think we should be saying to Democrats and Republicans alike, a plague on both your houses. Yes, there are good things you can find in both party platforms. Yes, there are good people in both parties, absolutely. But to simply identify ourselves with one or the other and to divide from fellow Christians over party politics, it cannot stand. So the first thing we do is we assemble. The second thing that we do is equip ourselves for battle. And we know what that looks like. That looks like the Word. It looks like the sacrament. It looks like studying the Bible and studying good books of theology. It means fasting, and it means praying, and it means discipline, and it means putting on what Paul talks about as the full armor of God in Ephesians 6. Thirdly, we prepare. We assemble, we equip, and we prepare. We prepare ourselves mentally for action. We live ready. We take on small suffering because we know that small suffering prepares us for big suffering. We refuse to be distracted by the things that we find in the world and on the internet. And we are always ready, as Peter puts it, to give an answer. You should live, he says, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. So we assemble ourselves, we equip ourselves, we prepare ourselves, and then finally and simply, we await orders. Things change quickly. The world changes on a dime. I think if there's any lesson from this year, it's that things do not continue forever as we know them. And sometimes decades worth of change seems to happen in a matter of weeks. Opportunities arise, attacks come, suffering comes, but above all, conquest. And the Lord opens doors wide for gospel obedience to him, for service to his kingdom, things that we could not possibly have anticipated days before. And we want to be ready. And when the order comes, we want to take it. We are the daughter of armies. We are the bride of the God of armies. And the world belongs to us. Yes, that is the kind of crazy thing you will hear in your church. The world belongs to the people of God. It really does. At all times, the ruler from Bethlehem is acting. And when he wants us to act, he will let us know. For now, pull yourselves together. Second to last chunk is verses 7 through 9 of chapter 5. Where we read that then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which delay not for a man nor wait for the children of man. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which when it goes through treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver. Your hands shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. Well, this is a turn, isn't it? This is a change. We're used to thinking about the people of God as sheep, and now we hear that they are to be like lions, or they're going to be like lions. But first we hear that the remnant will be like dew, and dew is pervasive and mysterious. I grew up in the country. I've been up really late at night or up really early in the morning or even up all night, and I've yet to actually see all the dewdrops just forming on the grass on a summer night. I'm sure if you're patient enough, look closely enough, more patient than I am, you could see it. But it's a mystery. You go to bed and there's nothing on the ground, and you get up and it's all covered with dew. And in the same way, the remnant is going to be pervasive and mysterious. And furthermore, the remnant will be like dew among the nations, will be a blessing and a refreshment to them. And in every place where you see water coming from heaven, with the exception of like a couple of floods, in every place you see dew coming from heaven, it's a blessing and a refreshment. Remember that the remnant is not just the stump, but what grows from it. It won't just be a little dew. It'll be dew that covers the land everywhere. Being in exile somehow does not ruin us. We increase and do not decrease. And that happens through a quiet and faithful witness. It happens through self-sacrificial missions. It happens through quiet and faithful educating of our children. And we are, as Augustine says, the best citizens of the earthly city, because we are also citizens of the heavenly city. And so we soak into and we permeate and we cause the nations to flourish. Our presence in the world is a blessing to the world. And yet, in the very next verse, the remnant is described not as dew, blessing, soaking, causing growth and refreshment. The remnant is described as a devouring lion. And not just the hunting lion that has to work really hard to find something to eat out in the forest or the wilderness, but a young lion among sheep. where it's just good living all day. You just eat all those sheep and nothing can stop you. Victorious over our enemies. And the world is right to be worried about us. Not because we have guns, because in most times and places, we have lived without arms. And not because we have political power. Political power is sort of a little bit of a benefit or a blessing at best, a terrible diversion and distraction at worst. Not because we're obnoxious and rebellious, because we're not. We are to be the very best citizens of the United States, but because nothing can stand in our way. Or rather, nothing can stand in the way of the shepherd from Bethlehem Ephrathah, who is also known as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. In the last section, verses 10 through 15. And in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you, and will destroy your chariots. And I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. And I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no more tellers of fortunes. And I will cut off your carved images and your pillars from among you, and you shall bow down no more to the work of your hands. And I will root out your Asherah images from among you and destroy your cities. And in anger and wrath I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. What's going on here? Two things. First, the Lord will cleanse his people. And second, the Lord will make his people into conquerors. The Lord will cleanse his people. And he'll cleanse them really of three things in this passage. First is he will cleanse them of their militarism, their love for and their trust in military might. Second, of their sorcery, and very closely tied to that, of their idolatry in verses 13 and 14. Now, of these, only one comes as a surprise to me. If you've read the Bible for more than about 15 minutes, you'll know that God does not like idols or sorcery, right? No surprise there. But I have to say that the militarism thing comes as a little bit of a surprise and a little bit of an affront to me. And he brings up two categories of militarism, love of military, building up a big military, trusting in that military. The first is offensive weapons. He says, I will cut off your horses and your chariots. These are the heavy weapons of the ancient world. And we read in Deuteronomy chapter 17 that when the people of Israel got a king, which they didn't at the time, when they got a king, the king must not, God gives some rules for the king, including that he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. But as soon as Israel has a king, and we find this certainly with King Solomon, David's son, the kings like to import both. They like to get their war horses, and they like to get their chariots, and they like to build up big armies. And this is no surprise to us, is it? When you have a strong government, the strong government wants to be a strong nation with a great big strong army. Now, there's an argument for that, which I'll get into in a second, but this is clearly something that God is not okay with. The second thing that he lists is defensive fortifications. He talks about cities, and he talks about strongholds. And when he talks about destroying your cities, I don't think he's just saying, I don't like you, and I'm going to wipe your cities off the map. He's saying, I'm going to remove the fortifications that you're trusting in. Now again, in Micah's day, there was a lot of this. King Hezekiah had a tremendous amount of money. He was a very, very wealthy king. He'd sent enormous tributes to the Assyrians, but he also had enormous treasures in his treasury, which wound up getting him in trouble, but that's another story. And Hezekiah had built up Jerusalem as a nearly impregnable fortified city. He had built a ring of other fortified cities around Jerusalem, places like Lachish, which is specifically prophesied against in the book of Micah. Hezekiah was on the verge of becoming a great power in the region, and he had done a lot to make his people powerful. So when we see the defensive fortifications coming down, that's part of that. That's part of that trust in their military might. And I have to tell you, I have never really thought about this very much as a problem. maybe a little bit uncomfortable with things like nuclear weapons. I wish nobody had any, right? But if anybody's going to have any, I'd rather we had a whole bunch of them, because I think I trust my country more than most other countries to use them well. But I've never really thought about this. And if you're hearing me and you're kind of on the left, you're saying, duh, of course, should be preaching against militarism every week. And if you're hearing me and you're kind of on the right, you're probably getting worried that you're going to get a big anti-war message. I don't think Christianity is anti-war or anti-military. That's far too general, far too general. But we may think we need a huge military to keep the other guys from getting out of hand. And I understand that. But we've had more than a century of great powers, military buildups, superpowers, world wars, proxy wars, and cold wars. And the more we choose to arm ourselves, the more our enemies do as well. And furthermore, as our friend Gabriel Wingfield was very fond of saying, a tool wants to be used. And if no war comes upon us, we will use our great military to bring war to others, which we have. This has been the bloodiest in warfare, the bloodiest 120 years of human history. And more to the point, we express by our actions that we trust in our city walls, our bows, and our swords. I do not think that God is calling us to pacifism or a refusal to defend ourselves, but God inevitably rebukes those nations that build huge armies, whether they do that defensively or offensively, and he calls all nations to trust in him as their defender. Does that sound naive? Sounds naive to me. But I notice two things. One is related to this, not exactly the same thing, but pretty similar. In the New Testament, Paul calls us to obey human governments and show respect for our leaders. And we may say, well, he didn't have the horrible leaders that we have now. No, he had Emperor Nero of the Roman Empire. And we may look at Micah in the same way and say, well, you don't understand. We have superpowers breathing down our necks. They're ruthless. They'll stop at nothing. You don't know the Russians and the Chinese. Or fill in the blank, whoever it is you're worried about. He had the Assyrians next door. And as I've said, without exaggeration in the past, the Assyrians made the Nazis look like Boy Scouts. They were really, really bad news. And they were way, way larger in relation to Israel than any of our enemies are in relation to us. And yet God says, do not put your trust in your princes. Do not trust in your sword. Do not trust in your bow. Do not trust in your fortified city. Do not trust in your money. Do not trust in all of the troops that you've counted up. Trust me. And he promises to carry out a foreign policy better than anything we could come up with. He says in the very last verse, in anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. And his policies and his priorities will be carried out. And so through the prophet, God has made us wonderful promises. We don't need to be afraid of exile or suffering. Our king is with us now, and he will be with us in even greater ways in the days to come. We do not win our wars by being great and mighty. He makes an army out of the lame and the scattered. He calls us his beautiful daughter, strong, lovely, fruitful, lasting, but at the same time awesome as an army with banners. He calls us simply to pull ourselves together, to be his faithful and vigilant people. He tells us that our presence among the nations will grow as both a blessing to them and as a threat to them. He warns us not to worship idols or to love military power. And he promises, and he has kept his promise, to send a ruler by way of Bethlehem, a shepherd who will defend us and avenge us so that we need fear nothing. Let's pray. Lord, walking through Micah feels like fireworks going off around us on the 4th of July. He has so many things to say. So many of them are shocking and hard to take. So many of them are strange. But they are so beautiful. And they are such good news to us. Because we often feel ourselves in exile. We often struggle in our individual lives, but also as churches and as the people of God in this nation and in all the nations of the earth to know what to do. We groan as if we were in labor with a child. We wonder where our help will come from. We pray, like the psalmist did, who will show us any good? But you have shown us your face, and you have kept your promise. And the fact that we sit here in this room worshiping you on the other side of the world from where Micah lived, 2,000 years and more later from when he lived, shows that you have been keeping these promises. You have raised up a ruler born in Bethlehem Ephrathah. You have raised up a shepherd who shepherds his people and shepherds his enemy with the sword. You have begun that process of cleansing your people, and you continue it. So I pray, Lord, that as individual people and as families and as a church and as all the people of God in this nation and in this world, we would pull ourselves together. That we would not forsake assembling together. That we would not let foolish and secondary things divide us from one another. That we would equip ourselves with the good things that you have provided for us. That we would prepare our minds and our hearts for actions, and that we would await your orders. And Lord, we stand before you today, awaiting your orders. Tell us what you want us to do. And if it's wait, that's okay. But Lord, let us be found faithful and ready when the day comes. We praise you and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.